Well, brethren, last time we started a multiple-part sermon series on the subject of biblical gender roles. And as I mentioned last time, it's going to be a multiple-part series because this is a very large topic. So what I'd like to do today is pick up on part two of this series. And so if you'd like a title for the sermon, it's Biblical Gender Roles Part Two. Again, Biblical Gender Roles Part Two. As I mentioned last time, this is a very large topic that we're certainly not going to cover in a single sermon or two. It's going to take multiple installments to do this, because again, a very large topic and lots to cover. And as I covered last time, I basically kind of covered what I said was kind of defining the problem. And as we know, this is a very large topic, and there's never been a time in human history, you know, where we've, you know, as in any society, has really practiced gender roles the way God intended, you know, and followed his instructions and had things work out the way he intended. That's never been the case. But in terms of defining the problem, I chose to focus on, as I said, primarily the feminist movement that has been the primary cultural push in, you know, in the U.S. and other Western nations for like the past 40 to 50 years. And again, the reason I kind of focused more in establishing the foundation for that is because this has been the primary pervasive issue in our culture over the last several decades. As I demonstrated last time, we see this, you know, throughout our entertainment all the time, in our educational system, just very pervasive in our culture. And as it stated, as I quoted last time, the stated objective of this movement has been literally the removal of biblical gender roles from our entire culture. You know, it hasn't been just trying to get us off track a little bit, but again, to completely remove the concept. And the way it's done that is basically, you might say, through a two-pronged approach. The whole cultural push that it has brought about is really been, again, two different ways of approaching this. One is by convincing our culture that masculinity is in one way or another inherently, you know, pathological, you might say, or problematic. So therefore, you know, men need to be feminized, you know, for the safety of mankind. They've also taken the approach of basically convincing us that taking a feminine role is inherently, basically equates with oppression and victimization. And of course, nobody would want to be a victim. And that then convinces women that they need to take up and basically take a masculine role and compete with men for a masculine role in that regard, you know, or otherwise it's going to equate with victimization. So basically what you have now is taking both sides and teaching them they should completely abandon the roles that God intended and take a completely different role. And as I demonstrated last time, you know, you can actually chart, you know, from the 1960s forward, the devastating results of this. Because if you look at the statistics, what you're going to see is a skyrocketing divorce rate, a dropping marriage participation rate, and a skyrocketing illegitimacy rate. In other words, we're looking now across the board in every demographic in the U.S., between about 40% and 50% of new births of children being born today are born into homes where marriage is not even in the equation, you know, for the parents at the time it's born. You get societal breakdown. So you can see what's happening here is basically just tearing apart the family in America. You know, what I'd like to do today is pick up on part two and continue forward, kind of establishing the foundation for this series. Because as I mentioned, the objective here that they've gone about approaching this subject is not just, you know, teaching us and brainwashing us to basically try to take these roles out of our culture. They basically also tried to demonize anyone who would ever even suggest that the biblical gender roles, as God defines in the Bible, is a good idea and something we should follow. And one of the core philosophies that's put across to basically, you know, demonize anyone who would talk about this idea is based upon the concept of equality. Now, you'll see this idea of equality very extant in our culture today. As I mentioned last time, it's the sales pitch not only for the feminist movement, for socialism, for multiculturalism. It is very pervasive in the philosophies of our culture today. And as this idea pertains to, you might say, roles or gender roles of individuals, it's the idea that everything about roles should be completely exactly the same and interchangeable. And if it's not equally interchangeable in every way possible, well, that's viewed as inequality. And that, therefore, based upon this philosophy, equates with the idea that someone must be being victimized or oppressed because they're being cheated out of equality. And again, it's a very flawed idea. And what we're also going to see as we go through this sermon, it's oftentimes a very cherry-picked idea. But I'll get back to that later, exactly what that means. But first of all, I think we need to understand that this concept of equality, again, defined from the idea that everything about roles are exactly interchangeable and exactly the same, you know, that not being the case is somehow some grave injustice of inequality, is a very flawed idea. Because first of all, I want you to see that that is not how God works with people. It is very common in terms of how God works with people. And again, much larger than just the roles of men and women, to place people in different roles for different purposes with different responsibilities and different parameters around those roles. And we'll also see that typically every role comes with an upside and a downside. And we can't look at it from a cherry-picked point of view. In other words, just selectively pulling, you know, a certain point of, you know, a piece of facts to create a narrative. But let's first of all, again, just look at the idea that this is very common of how God works with people. He doesn't place everyone in interchangeable, exactly the same roles. So let's turn over, first of all, to 1 Corinthians chapter 12 and just see a general principle of how God works. And because he's explaining here in 1 Corinthians 12, this is the Apostle Paul, you know, talking about how God works with the church. We're going to start in 1 Corinthians chapter 12 in verse 12. For as the body is one and has many members, but all members of that body being many are one body, so also is Christ. For by one Spirit we are all baptized into one body, whether Jews or Greeks, whether slaves or free, and have all been made to drink into one Spirit. For in fact the body is not one member, but many. If the foot should say, because I am not a hand, I am not of the body, is it therefore not of the body? And if the ear should say, because I am not an eye, I am not of the body, is it therefore not of the body? If the whole body were an eye, where would be the hearing? And if the whole were hearing, where would be the smelling? But now God has set the members, each one of them, in the body, just as he pleased. And if there were all one member, where would the body be? But now indeed there are many members, yet one body. And the eye cannot say to the hand, I have no need of you, nor again the head to the feet, I have no need of you. No much more, these members of the body which seem to be weaker are necessary. And these members of the body which we think to be less honorable, on these we bestow greater honor. And our representable part, our unrepresentable parts have greater modesty. But our presentable parts have no need. But God composed the body, having given greater honor to that part which lacks it, and that there should be no schism in the body, and that the members should have one and the same care for one another. And if one member suffers, all the members suffer with it. And if one member is honored, all the members rejoice with it. Now you are of the body of Christ and members individually. And God has appointed these in the church, first apostles, second prophets, third teachers, after that, miracles, then gifts of healings, helps, administrations, varieties of tongues. Are all apostles? Are all prophets? Are all teachers? Are all workers of miracles? Do all have gifts of healing? Do all speak with tongues? Do all interpret? But earnestly desire the best gifts, and yet I show you a more excellent way. Now, if you notice in those last couple of verses, he's asking a lot of rhetorical questions. The answer to every one of them is obviously no. You know, he's saying, are all in the same role? No. Do all have the same gifts and talents? No. Because he's assigned them differently, again, for the overall good of everyone. And realize, this doesn't mean anyone's been cheated or anyone's a second-class citizen or been oppressed. He's saying he's done this for the overall good of everyone. He's given different responsibilities and different roles to different individuals, again, for their good and for the benefit of the entire whole, because we need that for the overall collective good. And realize, notice by virtue of even how this is described, they're not all exactly the same and interchangeable. And it's not some inherent crime, you know, that one, you know, doesn't have the exact same role of the other. The way I like to look at it is kind of like this. You know, the Bible refers to God as our Father. And it's kind of like he's the dad, you know, and we're his children. And he's got all of his little kids down here on the playground on planet Earth, you know. And what he's done is he's over supervising all the little kids on the playground, and he gives them all different sandboxes to play in. And everybody's got their own sandbox and their own toys to play with, and he's assigned them accordingly as he sees fit, again, for the overall benefit of everyone. But not every sandbox is the same. You know, different sandboxes have different sizes and maybe different shapes and different color sand in them and different toys he gave to them all. But he assigned us all, again, for our benefit and for the overall good, and he tells us to play in our own sandbox with our own toys. But as human beings, we're carnal, and we deal with envy and lust and greed and such, and sometimes what we do is we're playing in our sandbox, and we look over at the kid in the sandbox next to us, and we go, well, he's got some shiny toys in that sandbox. That looks cool. I'd like that toy. And he said, well, I'm just as good of a kid as he is. Well, I deserve that too. You know, and we wanted to reach over in our sandbox and take that toy. But what we don't realize is, first of all, we're stepping across the boundary lines here, because we're oftentimes cherry picking. Because what we're going to see also is, it's not just an issue if he got those particular toys in that sandbox. Oftentimes there's different maintenance that comes with that sandbox as well. You know, there's different responsibilities, you might say. The point I'm getting at is there's different upsides and downsides, and they come together, and we can't cherry pick. But see, it's our human nature that we oftentimes want to step across that boundary line and think, well, I want their toys. Or sometimes we get really greedy and go, well, I want both sandbox. I want to roll my sandbox, and I want to roll their sandbox too, because I think I just deserve it. And we want to step over there and take over someone else's sandbox. What we're going to see today is God responds to this typically very negatively. You know, he can have a very negative response to this. And typically, not only will he just slap us down sometimes, tell us to get back in your own sandbox, sometimes he gets very ticked off and says, okay, you won't play in your own sandbox? You get no sandboxes, and you get no toys. And he takes it all completely away. And then we'll see some examples of that today. But we also need to realize in this, one, first of all, realize the concept of different roles and people being, responding to, different responsibilities and different parameters around those roles is not unique to the idea of men versus women. Because oftentimes this subject gets looked at, from those that want to put down the Bible as a sexist, archaic, anti-women kind of book. It's a cherry-picked view, and they're looking at it again from just selective facts to create a narrative. Well, if you look at this, I mean, God assigns people lots of different roles, and again, that's not inherently oppressive. That's for the overall good of everyone. And we need to play according to the roles that God has given us and how he's assigned that. Because again, the consequences of that can be severe. But we also need to realize the basic human tendency to cherry pick. And what I mean by that is oftentimes, is like to use the analogy, we'll look over at someone else's sandbox and why we want the benefits they have. And oftentimes what we want to do is we want to grab the benefits. We're not so concerned about the downside. You can keep the downside, just give me the perks. That's oftentimes how we tend to look at it. But with roles, there oftentimes comes an upside and a downside, and they come as a package. So let's first of all notice this as a biblical principle. Turn over to Mark chapter 10. It's Mark chapter 10 and verse 35. Again, Mark 10 and verse 35. What we're going to see here is a conversation that James and John, oftentimes referred to as the sons of thunder because of their personality, they're making a request here to Jesus Christ. But as we're going to see here, they're cherry-picking in terms of their view of things. It says in verse 35, then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him saying, teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask. That's a loaded way to start a conversation. I want you to do whatever I want. Okay, in verse 36, and he said to them, what do you want me to do for you? And then they said to him, grant us that we may sit on your right hand and the other on your left in your glory. Now notice what they're focused on. We want all the perks. We want the chief seats. We want the glory and all the benefits. And that sounds great to us. And notice Christ's immediate response. But Jesus said to them, you do not know what you ask. In other words, you're cherry picking. You're only looking at one side of the story. But let me tell you what comes with this. Can you drink the cup that I drink and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with? See, what Christ is pointing out to them is you're just, you're being human and carnal, and you're just focused on the glory and the upside. Let me tell you, there's a nasty downside that comes with that, and you can't take just one without the other. It's a package deal. Do you want the whole deal? That's basically what he's asking them. In verse 39, and they just said to him, we can. And Jesus said to them, you will indeed drink the cup that I drink and be baptized with what I am baptized. With the baptism I am baptized with, you will be baptized. But to sit on my right hand and on my left is not mine to give, but it is for those for whom it is prepared. In other words, you got to earn that deal. I can't promise you that outcome. But if you want the downside, we can arrange that. I can give you that one. But because think about it. I mean, Christ winds up in the chief seat, in the role from this. He's King of Kings and Lord of Lords. But what did he go through? To be placed in this role. Well, he got taken captive, he got beaten and tortured and humiliated and then violently murdered. And basically what he's saying to them, you want to receive the same thing? Well, think about how most of the apostles died. Most of them went through harsh trials. You know, they died violent death, being martyred, you know, fulfilling God's will. You know, this is what he's pointing out to them. It's like, hey, you want the chief seats? There's a nasty downside that comes with this. And you can't cherry pick. You can't just take the part that you want. You get the whole deal. And so that's very important to realize when we look at roles, is oftentimes there's an upside and a downside. Because our human tendency is to go, well, I want all the perks. And oftentimes that's our definition of equality. But because think about it like this. This whole, you know, concept of equality is, as I mentioned, is also the sales pitch for socialism. And this is a little bit off the subject, but I think this will illustrate where I'm going with this. You know, the idea of socialism is based upon the concept of the redistribution of wealth. You know, the idea of equality is, well, everyone has the same financial resources, the same, you know, standard of living. And if someone doesn't, well, that means it's inequality and they've been oppressed. But what you'll hear oftentimes is the concept of, I want equality, I want my fair share. And what they typically want their fair share of is the profits and the wealth. But because oftentimes what you don't hear is people demanding their fair share of all the work, the sacrifice, the risk that came in producing that wealth. You know, they're like, no, you can keep all the work and the sacrifice and stuff. Just give me the fair share of the profits. That's not equality. That's not a fair share. That's a cherry-picked view. And we have to keep in mind, that's what we as carnal human beings tend to do when we look at subjects. So again, what I want to do now is go through a couple of examples from the Bible. Again, looking at the concept of roles, because I want you to see several things in this. One, for starters, this concept of God placing people in different roles with different parameters around them and different responsibilities, different upsides and downsides, is not unique to the concept of men versus women at all. There's lots of contexts where God places people in different roles with different responsibilities in lots of different contexts. And this isn't, by no means makes anyone oppressed or cheated or, you know, out of their equality or oppressed or a second-class citizen in any way. And this is just kind of a common concept. But realize it's a natural human tendency for people to want to step over into someone else's role and try to take over that. And you're going to notice a number of examples here where God responds very negatively to that. People get slapped down really hard, you know, when they're trying to step across that boundary line, take over someone else's sandbox and take their toys. You know, and God responds very negatively to that. So let's turn on, first of all, over to Numbers chapter 12. So Numbers chapter 12, we'll start in verse 1 here. And we're going to go through a very familiar story to a lot of us here. This is the story of Miriam and Aaron questioning Moses. And what we're going to see here as we go through this, all three of these people have very specific roles that God has placed them in. They're all in spiritual leadership roles that God has designated for all of them. So there's nobody here who's been minimalized and, you know, is being cheated as a second-class citizen or oppressed in any way, shape, or form. But that doesn't justify them stepping across those boundary lines and trying to take someone else's role and try to take over their sandbox, basically. We're going to see God responds to that very negatively. Let's notice now in Numbers 12 and verse 1. Then Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Ethiopian woman whom he had married, for he had married an Ethiopian woman. And they said, "Has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us also?" And the Lord heard it. I notice that this is the dialogue between Miriam and Aaron. They're saying, well, aren't we in leadership roles too? Don't we have just as much right? Now, we're going to notice a little bit later, there's some truth to that claim. Because they're both in designated leadership roles, you know, that God has placed them in. So their claim of, does God work through us too? Yes, he does. So there's validity to that. That doesn't justify them trying to step across the line of Moses' role. Because this is what they get slapped down for. They're basically trying to say, well, you know, aren't we equal? Aren't we just as good to tell him what to do? And they're trying to step over into Moses' role and tell him how to run his life. And God doesn't respond to this very well at all. So notice here in verse 4. And suddenly the Lord said to Moses, Aaron, and Miriam, "Come out here, you three, to the tabernacle of meeting." So the three came out. And the Lord came down in the pillar of cloud and stood in the door of the tabernacle and called Aaron and Miriam. And they both went forward. And then he said, "Hear now my words, If there is a prophet among you, I, the Lord, make myself known to him in a vision, and I speak to him in a dream. Not so with my servant Moses. He is faithful in all my house. I speak with him face to face, even plainly, and not in dark sayings. And he sees the form of the Lord. Why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant Moses? See, what's happening here is God's reaching down and slapping their hands, saying, this is not your sandbox. These are not your toys. You need to get back in your own sandbox and play with the toys I gave you, because you have no business here and you are overstepping your boundary lines. But because basically what's happening is they've decided, well, aren't we equal? Don't we get just as much? Aren't we just as good as he is? But they're trying to step over and take over Moses' role. And God is not a fan of this. You know, and notice what has happened here. So let's pick up here in verse 9. So the anger of the Lord was aroused against them, and he departed. And when the cloud departed from above the tabernacle, suddenly Miriam became leprous, as white as snow. And Aaron towards Miriam, and there she was a leper. And so Aaron said to Moses, O my Lord, please do not lay this sin on us, in which we have done foolishly, in which we have sinned. Please do not let her be as one dead, whose flesh is half consumed, and when he comes out of his mother's womb. Now, honestly, whenever I read this story, I have to chuckle a little bit that Aaron's jumping in, you know, pleading for mercy for her. Because, I mean, I'm sure he's concerned about his sister, but realize he was involved in the crime as well. You know, and he's been corrected as well. For all he knows, he's getting leprosy next. You know, so of course he wants her to get mercy. You know, he wants this to go away, because all he knows, for all he knows, he's about to get leprosy too. You know, so let's pick up again here in verse 13. So Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, please heal her, O God, I pray. And then the Lord said to Moses, If her father had but spit in her face, would she not be shamed 7 days? And let her be shut out of the camp 7 days, and after that she may be received again. So Miriam was shut out of the camp 7 days, and the people did not journey on until Miriam was brought in again. Now we're going to come back here in a minute and talk about the concept of why she might have been the person singled out to get the leprosy. Because you notice that they were both involved in the crime, they both get corrected, but she gets singled out for the harsh punishment. We're going to come back to that in a minute. But first of all, remember, as we started off with this, that they both mention, does the Lord not work through us too? You know, aren't we important too? You know, aren't we in leadership roles? Don't we get our say? Well, I want you to realize, for starters, there's some truth to that statement. Because there's nobody here who's been marginalized or who's a second-class oppressed, you know, citizen in this scenario. All of them have very important roles. Again, that doesn't justify them trying to take over Moses' role, but they all have, again, very significant roles that they're placed in. So let's notice, first of all, let's turn over to Exodus chapter 15, and let's notice the roles that both of them have been placed in. Exodus chapter 15, we're going to start here in verse 20. So then Miriam the prophetess, the sister of Aaron, took the timbrel in her hand, and all the women went out after her with timbrels and with dances. And Miriam answered them, sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. The horse and its rider he has thrown into the sea. Notice it directly mentions here that Miriam is a prophetess. So again, when she makes the, you know, when they make the claim, you know, doesn't God work through us too? Well, yes, yes, he does. You know, they're both in leadership roles as well. Again, that doesn't justify their actions. But I want you to see here is that, you know, nobody's a downtrodden second-class citizen who's been marginalized. You know, they both have significant roles, but that doesn't justify them stepping across the line and trying to take over somebody else's role. You know, you got to play in your own sandbox with your own toys. You know, but it's also notice in Exodus 28, the same thing is true of Aaron. He's in a very significant role as well. It's Exodus chapter 28, and we'll start here in verse 1. It says, now take Aaron your brother, his sons, and his sons with him from among the children of Israel, that he may minister to me as priest. Aaron and Aaron's sons, Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar. And you shall make a holy garments for Aaron your brother, for glory and for beauty. So you shall speak to all who are gifted artisans, who I am filled with the spirit of wisdom, that they may make Aaron's garments to sanctify him, that he may minister to me as priest. And these are the garments which ye shall make: a breastplate, an ephod, a robe, a skillfully woven tunic, a turban, and a sash. So you shall make holy garments for Aaron your brother and his sons, that he may minister to me as priest. So he's talking about the establishment of the Levitical priesthood here, you know, which we oftentimes refer to also as the Aaronic priesthood, because again, they're the descendants of Aaron. But notice again here, when they make the comment, doesn't God work through us as well? Well, yes, he does, because they're both in significant roles. Well, we see that Miriam was a prophetess and Aaron is a priest. In fact, we're going to see he's high priest. You know, he has a very special role, and his sons are also priests as well. But let's also keep in mind, again, roles come with an upside and a downside. We can't just look at them as cherry picking in terms of, well, they get to have this special role. Because as we're going to see here in regards to Aaron and his sons, yes, they're Levites, and they get a special role in the tabernacle that they get to fulfill. And we're going to see that Aaron has a very special role, that he's the only one in Israel that gets to go into the Holy of Holies on the Day of Atonement to do the two-goat ceremony. But there's a downside that comes with this as well. And let's turn over now to Leviticus chapter 16 and look at that. So Leviticus chapter 16 and verse 1. It says, now the Lord spoke to Moses after the death of the two sons of Aaron, that they offered profane fire before the Lord and died. Now notice this, in fulfilling their roles as priests, they didn't follow God's instructions the way he wanted them to, and they got killed for it. You know, so it wasn't just the issue of, well, yeah, they're the priesthood and they get to do the special role in the tabernacle. They're also the guys who get to get killed if they do it wrong. You know, as you can see, as a general rule, God takes the point of view to whom much is given, much is required. You know, in other words, if he gives special responsibilities, there's oftentimes a downside, you know, an accountability that comes with that. And we can't just look at it as, well, oh, they get all the perks, you know, and they get this special role. No, they also get to die if they do it wrong. And we can see this is true of Aaron's role as well, because Aaron is the high priest. Now, the high priest was the only individual who got to go into the Holy of Holies, and he got to do it just once a year on the Day of Atonement, because the instructions were very specific. You can't go in there any other time. You can only do it on this day, and you can only do it, you know, according to these instructions. And Aaron is the guy, you know, again, gets the special privilege of doing all this. He's also the guy who gets to die if he does it wrong. It's a package deal. Let's notice in verse 2. And the Lord said to Moses, tell Aaron your brother not to come at simply any time into the holy place inside the veil before the mercy seat, which is on the ark, lest he die. For I will appear in the cloud above the mercy seat. So notice here, he's given this and told you, you can come only on this one day. If you do it any other time, I'm going to kill you. You know, so again, he gets the privilege of doing it. He also gets to die if he does it wrong. Well, it's not just a matter of the timing, it's also the details of how he's supposed to do the job. If you glance over at verse 13, and this is again referring to the instructions of what Aaron's supposed to do when he goes in on the Day of Atonement to do this ceremony. He says, and he shall put incense on the fire before the Lord, that the cloud of incense may cover the mercy seat that is on the testimony, lest he die. In other words, if he doesn't follow the instructions and do it exactly the way God told him to, he's the guy that gets killed. So you understand, again, roles come with an upside and a downside, and they come together. We can't cherry pick and say, well, I just want the benefits, don't want the downside. It doesn't work that way. Also notice this as well. This is a unique role that Aaron gets to play. Moses doesn't get to do this either. You know, because if Moses were to step across this boundary line and say, well, I want to go into the Holy of Holies and I want to do this, that'd be a good way to get killed, you know, because God said, you know, anybody else does this, I'm going to kill them, you know. So again, they both have their unique special roles of what they're supposed to play. This doesn't make anyone victimized or marginalized or cheated out of their equality. It's just how God has assigned them. And they all come with an upside and a downside. Now let's look at the question of why was it that Miriam was the one singled out for the leprosy? Now, the Bible doesn't specifically tell us the answer to this, so we have to speculate a little. But as we notice, I mean, the Bible directly tells us it was Miriam and Aaron who were both questioning Moses. They both were guilty of the crime. And when God comes out and, you know, has the conversation and slaps them both down for it, he's addressing both of them. So obviously they're both guilty of this. But why is it that Miriam gets the harshest punishment? You know, she gets the leprosy, she gets kicked out of the camp for a week, and not Aaron. Well, some of the most common speculation I've heard throughout my life is that, well, maybe she was the ringleader. You know, maybe she was kind of leading the charge to go down this road and therefore more accountable in that regard. That's possible. We can't prove that. But again, that's often speculated. Let me add a little more speculation here that I think we can demonstrate a little more clearly. Because again, in terms of the ringleader, we can guess at that, but how do you prove that? You know, but I think one of the things that we can demonstrate from the Bible is the concept of cherry picking. Because think about it like this. What they're both basically wanting is their say. They're wanting to judge Moses in terms of how he's lived his life and tell him how to do things. And God's slapping them down saying, you know, he's in a special role. He's in charge of running the nation. You should stay out of his sandbox. You know, that's my job to be judging him. So basically what they're wanting is their equality in their say. But think about it. You know, to whom much is given, much is required. Moses' role was a lot more than just being the guy in charge, you know, who got to dish out the instructions and tell people what to do. Because yes, I mean, he was the guy leading the nation that was oftentimes doing the delegating and making the judgments and was in charge. He's also the guy that gets to deal with them every time they're upset. Because follow that one through the Bible, every time Israel gets unhappy, you know, with their circumstances, what are they doing? And all Israel murmured against Moses, you know, and they're all ready to, you know, to take him on. You know, or if they're getting real upset and they're ready to riot and ready to stone somebody, who are they ready to stone? It's Moses. So his job is not just, you know, getting to be in the limelight and being in charge and telling people what to do. He's the guy that gets the headaches to deal with every time they're upset and angry, and every time they want to riot and they want to kill somebody, he's the guy they want to kill. And he has the headaches of dealing with all of this. You know, so he has the upside and the downside. Now let's look at the concept of cherry picking. Because if you follow the examples throughout the Old Testament where, you know, this kind of thing is mentioned, where all of Israel gets upset and they're murmuring against Moses and they're all upset, there's a number of times you're going to see Aaron's name mentioned as well. It's going to say all of Israel, you know, murmured against Moses and Aaron. In other words, they kind of lump them together. So even though, again, this doesn't justify Aaron trying to step into Moses' role, he is taking a good bit of the flack of the leadership, you know, responsibility that Moses is as well by virtue of the fact that he's mentioned. There's not one time in the Bible when Miriam's name is ever mentioned in that context. You never see a situation where all of Israel was upset and they're murmuring against Miriam. That's never mentioned. Or they're all upset and they want to stone somebody and Miriam's the one they want to throw the rocks at. That never happens once. So what she's doing here is, you know, she wants her equality, she wants her say. You know, doesn't God work through us? I want to tell Moses how to do his job. She's not taking the flack. You know, so she's doing the most cherry picking. But also notice this, and again, I'm not picking on Miriam, that this is just human nature. But notice also, you know, when they want their say and they want to tell Moses how to do his job, well, doesn't God work through us too? Aren't we as good enough? We want our equality here. Do you ever see any example in the Bible where all of, you know, Moses, all of Israel's upset and they're ready to stone Moses, and Miriam's standing up and going, "Well, wait a minute, doesn't God work through me too? Aren't I just as deserving of all your anger and your hostility as him? You know, don't I deserve the rocks thrown at me too? You know, aren't I good enough for that?" You know, you never see that because, again, that's human nature. You know, we generally don't fight for our equality for the downside. You know, we want the perks. You know, you can keep all the people angry. I just want my say. You know, it doesn't work that way. Because the point is oftentimes as human beings, we want to cherry pick. And we want to take, you know, just the part that's beneficial to us. You can keep the downside, you know. Or sometimes if we want to characterize ourselves as a victim, well, we look at all the downside and we don't, you know, we kind of ignore the benefits we might receive. Again, it's human nature to want to cherry pick in that regard. So again, some of this is speculation, but again, you can demonstrate from the Bible that Miriam was never, you know, never receiving, you know, she's never mentioned for sure. I mean, you can definitely show that. She's never mentioned receiving the downside of this. And again, that's my opinion and speculation, but I suggest that's probably why God you know, singled her out for, you know, the leprosy. He's like, okay, you want the whole package? Let me show you the downside. You know, this is what comes with it. You can't just get your say and not have the other side with it as well. Let's also notice a couple other examples in the Bible, as you'll see here, people have stepped across boundary lines like this of their roles and how God responds to it. Because you can see with Miriam and Aaron, they basically just got kind of slapped down and told to get back in their own sandbox. But what we're going to see here is a couple of examples where God's, you know, judgment upon people after they do this is not just getting them back in their own sandbox, it's taking the sandbox they have away from them. You know, because he gets very upset at times when people step across this. But turn over to 1 Samuel chapter 13. We're going to see the example here of Saul and Samuel. Now, King Saul is the first king of Israel, and his role is to be basically the civil leader of the nation. Again, another thing I want you to notice in this story, there are no marginalized, downtrodden victims here. You know, no one's a second-class citizen. We're dealing with two individuals with very significant roles they have, but there's still the concept of God says, I've given you the sandbox, I've given you these toys, you need to play in the sandbox I gave you. You know, don't be stepping over trying to take over someone else's role. Because that's what happens here. Because we have Saul and Samuel, and Saul is the civil leader of the nation as the king. Samuel is a prophet, and his role is to be a spiritual leader. And again, there's different responsibilities, different parameters they're both given. And where Saul messes up here is what we're about to read, is he tries to step over into Samuel's sandbox and take on his responsibilities. And that doesn't turn out very well for him. Let's turn over to 1 Samuel 13 in verse 1. So Saul reigned 1 year, and when he had reigned 2 years over Israel, Saul chose for himself 3,000 men of Israel. 2,000 were with Saul in Michmash and in the mountains of Bethel, and 1,000 were with Jonathan in Gibeah of Benjamin. And the rest of the people he sent away, every man to his tent. And Jonathan attacked the garrison of the Philistines that was in Geba, and the Philistines heard of it. And then Saul blew the trumpet throughout all the land, saying, let the Hebrews hear. Now all Israel heard it and said that Saul had attacked a garrison of the Philistines, and that Israel had become an abomination to the Philistines. And the people were called together to Saul at Gilgal. Then the Philistines gathered together to fight with Israel, 30,000 chariots and 6,000 horsemen, and the people as the sand which is in the seashore in multitude. And they came up and encamped in Michmash to the east of Beth-Aven. And when the men of Israel saw that they were in danger, for the people were distressed, then the people hid in caves, in thickets, in rocks, in holes, and in pits. And some of the Hebrews crossed over the Jordan to the land of Gad and Gilead. And as for Saul, he was still in Gilgal, and all the people followed him, trembling. And then he waited 7 days according to the time set by Samuel. Because we're going to notice here, he had been told to wait for Samuel to come and do the sacrifices. He'd been told, that's not your job, that's Samuel's job. You need to wait for him to do that. And this is where he messes up. He doesn't wait. But Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and the people were scattered from him. So Saul said, bring the burnt offering and the peace offerings here to me. And he offered the burnt offering. Now it happened as soon as he had finished offering the burnt offering that Samuel came. And the Saul went out to greet him, that he might greet him. And Samuel said, what have you done? And Saul said, I saw that the people were scattered from me, that you did not come within the days appointed. And then the Philistines gathered together at Michmash. Then I said, the Philistines will now come down on me at Gilgal, and I have not made supplication for the Lord. Therefore I felt compelled and offered a burnt offering. And Samuel said to Saul, you have done foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. For now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. But now your kingdom shall not continue. And the Lord has sought for himself a man after his own heart. And the Lord has commanded him to be commander over his people, because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you. I notice he was told to wait, and he doesn't. I mean, yes, you know, Samuel doesn't show up exactly when he was expecting him. But again, he was told, this is not your sandbox. These are not your toys. It's not your job to be doing this, the sacrifices. That's going to be Samuel's role. Well, he doesn't respect that. And he steps across the line and thinks, well, I can do that too. Well, God doesn't respond to this very well. He gets very upset with him. But notice what happens here. He says, you know, you could have had your line, you know, and all of his descendants be the kings of Israel throughout generations. But because he blew it with this, God says, no, I'm not going to replace you with David. So if you notice what happens here, basically, you know, Saul's got his own sandbox and his own toys to play with. And he steps over and wants to take part of Samuel's sandbox. Well, what happens? He doesn't just get slapped down and told to get back into his own sandbox. He ultimately loses his own sandbox. You know, because that could have been passed down throughout his generations. And what happens after he dies is now David becomes king and a totally different line takes over. So you can see there's some harsh punishments here because he didn't respect the boundary lines. But again, notice once again here, this whole concept of equality as it's, you know, put across in our society doesn't even fit. Because again, their roles are unique and different. No one's being cheated. No one's being oppressed. They just have unique and different roles. But stepping across it and thinking I can take someone else's role, God doesn't respond well to that. You know, we have to play within the sandbox that God has given us. Now I want to ask a few questions here just to illustrate a point. And I'm even going to call these irrelevant questions because we're going to see that I'm kind of bring up some irrelevant issues here. But I think you'll understand here in a minute why I'm kind of demonstrating this. But I want you to see this in an example that's off the subject. As you notice here, Saul gets in a great deal of trouble for stepping over into Samuel's role and doing sacrifices. So does this mean that Saul's not smart enough to do sacrifices? That he's not capable enough? He's not a good enough person to do it? Or he's not physically capable of doing it? Or, you know, offering sacrifices is just too complicated and he can't figure it out? You know, is any of that what we're saying here? Of course not. These are irrelevant questions. We can trump up emotionally based issues associated with that. But think about this practically. Can he kill an animal and do sacrifices? Well, if he can lead an army into hand-to-hand combat, the way that they fought back then, I think it's pretty safe to assume he can take an animal and slaughter it and do a sacrifice. Is he not smart enough to figure out how to do it? I don't think he really needs a PhD in how to sacrifice animals to do it. None of that's the issue. It's not even relevant. The issue here is God had told him, this is not your role. This is Samuel's role. I've given this role to Samuel. So in other words, we can try to make up arguments here to say, well, he's being cheated and oppressed and it's inequality. It's all irrelevant because the issue is God has assigned Saul his role, and it was a very meaningful role, and he's assigned Samuel a different role, and he said, you need to play in the sandbox I've given you and with the toys I've given you, and don't be crossing the lines because I've told you not to do that. You know, and again, this had nothing to do with oppressing anyone or treating anyone as, you know, unimportant or a second-class citizen. Well, let's notice here as another example here. Let's turn over to 2 Chronicles 26. We're going to look at the example of King Uzziah. Second Chronicles 26 and verse 16. So when he was strong, his heart was lifted up, and his destruction, for he had transgressed the Lord his God by entering the temple of the Lord to burn incense on the altar of incense. Now, who we're talking about here is King Uzziah. Now he is king of Judah, and again has a very significant role. He's the civil leader of the nation. But what he's doing is he's stepping into the temple trying to do the Levitical priesthood's job. This does not go well. Look in verse 17. So Azariah, the priest, went in after him, and with him were 80 priests of the Lord who were valiant men. And they withstood King Uzziah and said to him, it is not for you, Uzziah, to burn incense to the Lord, but for the priests, the sons of Aaron, who are consecrated to burn incense. Get out of the sanctuary, for you have transgressed, and you shall have no honor from the Lord God. Then Uzziah became furious, and he had a censer in his hand to burn incense. And while he was angry with the priest, leprosy broke out on his forehead before the priests in the house of the Lord, beside the incense of altar. And Azariah, the chief priest, and all the priests looked at him, and there on his forehead he was leprous. So they thrust him out of that place, and indeed he was hurried to get out, because the Lord had struck him. And King Uzziah was a leper until the day of his death. He dwelt in an isolated house because he was a leper, for he was cut off from the house of the Lord. And then Jotham, his son, was over the king's house, judging the people of the land. Now notice that, once again, we're dealing with individuals here, both in designated leadership roles. Everybody has an important function to fulfill. But Uzziah gets it in his mind, hey, I'm going to go take over their sandbox. I think I'm just as good as they are, and I'm equal, and I'm going to go do that. What he does is he steps across the line and tries to take the Levitical priesthood's job. God does not care for this. And what does he wind up doing? He winds up losing his own sandbox, essentially. Because you see, he winds up with leprosy, and it says his son had to reign in his place from them. Well, he winds up basically losing the role that he had. Rather than being happy with what God had given him, he loses everything. You know, this didn't work out very well for him. So once again, let's ask some irrelevant questions. Is this saying that Uzziah is not capable enough? He's not smart enough to figure out how to burn incense? You know, he's not physically capable of doing it? It's just too complicated for him to figure out? Well, of course not. I mean, how complicated is it to burn some incense? He doesn't need a PhD in burning incense. I'm sure he can physically, you know, muster the job, and he's physically capable of doing it. None of that's the issue. The issue is he's been told, this isn't your role. This has been set aside for the Levitical priesthood, and this is their role, and you shouldn't be stepping across this. And see, that's what he gets in trouble for. And that's what we need to understand. When God assigns people different roles, again, it's not about, you know, putting someone down that they're a second class citizen or they're not capable of it. He's just saying, this is what I've assigned to this person. This is what I've assigned to this person. They both have upsides and downsides that come with them, and he expects us to respect that. Now, with this foundation in mind, now let's get back to some material more directly relevant to the concept of biblical gender roles. Turn back over to 1 Timothy chapter 1. Actually, 1 Timothy chapter 2. We're now going to look at some scriptures that you might say are rather controversial in our culture today. You know, not necessarily so much within the Church of God, but again, when you talk about these types of concepts from the Bible in our culture today, one of the first things you'll get up is, well, this is inequality and this is oppression, and you must think women are second-class citizens and you're for their oppression, is one of the things that will typically come up. And I want you to see here that this has nothing to do with anyone being a second-class citizen. It's simply about God assigning people different roles and assigning them different responsibilities. And we have to keep in mind, again, roles come with an upside and a downside. So notice here in 1 Timothy 2, verse 11. It says, let a woman learn in silence with all submission. I do not permit a woman to teach or to have authority over a man, but to be in silence. For Adam was formed first, then Eve. And Adam was not deceived, but the woman being deceived fell into transgression. Nevertheless, she will be saved in childbearing if they continue in faith, love, holiness, and with self-control. Now again, just mentioning that these kind of concepts, you know, in today's culture could quickly start an argument. But one of the first things you need to realize about this particular scripture to understand what it's saying is this is specifically referring to offices of leadership within the church. As we're going to see here in a minute, when we compare this to 1 Corinthians chapter 14, it makes some very similar comments, but you're going to see the words in church, you know, were referred to in that scripture. Because, you know, it talks about teaching and having authority there. Again, what it's referring to is, again, offices of leadership within the church. Because if you look, and we don't take the time to do it, but if you look at the qualifications for the ministry in the New Testament offices of the ministry and leadership of the church, one of the qualifications that you will see listed is the husband of one wife. Now, it's kind of difficult for a woman to be the husband of one wife, you know. So that kind of shows you right there, this is a role that's specifically designated for men. It's not something that God's saying that this is for men, this is not for women. This has nothing to do with saying that, well, women are not smart enough to know how to know their Bible or to study it or, you know, to have insights there. I can tell you many times in my life and in discussions I've had, you know, with women I've talked to who have taught me interesting things, that they've seen interesting insights that they've dug out of the Bible that I'd never even considered. I've been in a number of conversations where at times, I mean, I literally had the, you know, your jaw falling open when someone mentioned something and you go, wow, I never thought of that. You know, and that's happened to me a number of times talking to women. You know, so it's not an issue of women are not smart enough to know that or don't have the responsibility to, you know, to study their Bible and to be as well versed with it as men. They certainly do. We're all in training for the same job as first fruits. He's saying that he's assigned the responsibilities of leadership and teaching in the church. That's a role he's given to men. It's the same thing as dividing, you know, the role of the king versus the priesthood or something. It's just that's how God has assigned the roles. So understand it has nothing to do with making anyone a second-class citizen. Now let me also address one other thing. In verse 15 here, I'll just say, throughout my lifetime, I've heard what I'll just bluntly call some very goofy ideas attached to verse 15 here. Because if you read this verse, it says, "Nevertheless, she will be saved in childbearing if they continue in faith, love, and holiness with self-control." And some of the what I will call goofy ideas I've attached to this is sometimes people have taken the viewpoint of somehow this is saying that women are more inherently flawed than men, and like the act of childbearing somehow redeems them from this, and a woman's value is therefore attached to childbearing. That has nothing to do with what this verse is saying. This verse is referring back to Genesis 3, verse 15. You know, and I won't take the time to turn there. But notice, first of all, that this verse talks about she and then they. She is referring to Eve, who is referred to in the prior verses. They is referring to all mankind. Because, you know, it's referring to the, you know, Eve was the first one who sinned, who took a part of the forbidden fruit. But when it's talking about childbearing, it's referring to the fact that Christ would be a descendant of hers. You know, because if you read Genesis 3:15, it talks about the seed, you know, descending from the woman. Well, the seed is Christ. You know, and Christ is the one who redeems all mankind. But that salvation is conditional. So that's why it says, if they continue in faith, love, holiness, and self-control, because it requires overcoming. You know, so that's what that's referring to. It has nothing to do with saying women are more flawed inherently than men. But if you turn over to 1 Corinthians chapter 14, we'll see a similar concept referred to here. It's 1 Corinthians 14 and verse 33. It says, "For God is not the author of confusion, but of peace, as in all the churches of the saints. Let your women keep silent in the churches, for they are not permitted to speak, but they are to be submissive, as the law also says. And if they want to learn something, let them ask their own husbands at home, for it is shame for women to speak in church." Now again, please notice the words "in church" in these verses here. This is not saying, well, you know, women just need to shut up and stay in the kitchen because they have, you know, nothing valuable to add. That is not what this is talking about. It's saying that in positions of leadership and teaching in the church, that is a male role that has not been given to women. It's again how God has assigned the responsibilities. But again, if you're going to look at this, again, not from a cherry-picked point of view, realize there's two sides to every story. Because oftentimes, again, in our culture, we look at this and say, well, this is cheating women out of, you know, being in a leadership role and all the perks that can come with that. Realize there's a downside that comes with that role as well, and we have to look at both sides. Turn over to James chapter 3 and verse 1. Because I mentioned before, you know, God takes the point of view to whom much is given, much is required. In other words, if I've given a lot of person, I also, you know, require a lot from that individual. It's not just about receiving perks. There's two sides to the story. In James chapter 3, verse 1, he says, "My brethren, let not many of you become teachers, knowing you shall receive a stricter judgment." In other words, yeah, they may get the leadership role. They also get the response, you know, the accountability. And sometimes dealing with the flack, as you might say, kind of like Moses' role. Well, I said, you know, Moses got to be the guy in charge and delegating the responsibilities. He also got to receive all the negative emotion and all the upset when people were unhappy, and he got to deal with those problems. And let me just give you a couple of real-life examples. And I'll admit up front, these are kind of severe examples, but these are real-life situations because I knew the people involved in all of these scenarios. But just to demonstrate that being in a leadership role can have kind of, you might say, a significant downside as well. It's not just being in charge and getting to teach. Sometimes it's dealing with some severe problems. Now, both of these happened about 20 years ago or more. But this first example happened in, it was in a congregation, I want to say about 100 people or more. It was kind of sizable for today's standards. And there was a local elder who was up giving announcements one day. He didn't have the sermon that day. He was just assigned for giving announcements. And this was in the summer of the year. And in the course of giving the announcements, he's talking about the church's summer camp they're having that year and a number of the teenagers in the congregation that would be attending the camp. And he starts kind of listing out, you know, well, this kid and this kid and this kid are going to be a part of it. And he's not really working off of a list. He's kind of popping off the top of his head, remembering the names. Well, he happens to miss one of the names. And it wasn't anything on purpose. It was just, he just kind of forgot to mention one particular teenager's name as he's listing it. Well, it just so happened that the one teenager he forgot to mention, the parents of this individual, just to put it bluntly, were kind of combative, argumentative kind of individuals. And not only that, but there was an extended family of this, you know, these parents that were in this congregation as well. And they all kind of had similar personalities in that regard. There was also some history that had led up to this, where some other things that had happened with this elder kind of rubbed them wrong. You know, but again, knowing all the parties involved, a number of the issues were kind of about as significant as, you know, forgetting to mention their kid's name, you know, in going to summer camp. Well, the elder gets done making announcements. He steps down and goes back to his chair towards the back of the hall. Before he even gets to his chair, the parents meet him there, and they want to talk because they're upset and offended, you know, that their kid, because they took it very personally, like he did this on purpose as a personal insult to their child. Well, they pull him out in the parking lot because they want to talk about it and talk about it right now, you know. Well, within a few minutes, this elder finds himself standing out in the parking lot with not only the parents in front of him, but kind of surrounded by the extended family. And they are all severely upset with him over the situation. And again, there was more history than just this particular example. But this wasn't just a conversation of, you know, I don't understand why you did this and you kind of hurt my feelings and having a rational conversation. This very quickly escalated into kind of a screaming situation where they're all berating him, screaming at him. At least at one point, the father of the teenager was threatening him with physical violence. You know, I ought to just punch you out. And this kind of thing is what this conversation escalated into. This elder found himself, you know, for a lot of the rest of the sermon time of services, standing out in the parking lot, just trying to apologize for anything that he could, trying to fall on his sword to calm down this situation, you know, that was escalating with an entire family around him. Now, again, this is a severe example, but I want you to see both sides of the picture, because we can't just look at it like, well, this is cheating, you know, women out of being in a leadership role. Yeah, it's not just behind the podium teaching. You might be out in the parking lot being screamed at and threatened with physical violence. Speaking of violence, let me give you another example. This situation actually happened to a church host. It wasn't an actual elder of a congregation. And again, I admit these are both severe examples, but I'm picking them out for that reason. This was in a congregation, again, about 20-plus years ago. It was a small congregation that primarily worked off of videotapes, you know, that were sent from their headquarters organization. And they were primarily just the sermon that was being sent there. So locally, a lot of times they would do, you know, their opening and closing hymns and, you know, song leading and, you know, the prayers and sometimes sermonettes as well. And the host of the congregation kind of made these assignments and organized these other activities. Well, there was one particular couple in the congregation where the husband had not been asked to be a part of, you know, the song leading and things of that nature. Well, his wife took this very personally, you know, got very upset and thought it was a personal offense for them in that regard. Well, she got into a heated discussion with the host as to why, you know, her husband had not been a part of that, and she was greatly offended by this. This escalated to the point she literally punched the host in the face in the church hall. It wasn't during services, but it was at services. I mean, again, this is a very severe example, and I acknowledge that is such. But I just want you to see that, you know, being in a leadership role, there's two sides to this. We can't cherry pick the views, because yes, it may be that, well, yeah, he's excluding women from being behind the podium and being teachers. He's also excluding you from being out in the parking lot getting screamed at or punched in the face. You know, so you have to realize that there's two sides to the story, and we can't just cherry pick the views. Let's also look at one other scripture that's oftentimes, you know, again, very controversial or argued about on the subject of gender roles here. Turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 11. It's 1 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 2. Now, we're going to come back to this chapter later in this series as we go into more detail about the roles of men and women. But just to kind of cover what we're going to address today, it's 1 Corinthians 11 and verse 2. Now I praise you, brethren, that you remember me in all things and keep the traditions as I've delivered them to you. But I want you to know that the head of every man is Christ, and the head of woman is God, and the head of Christ is God. Now notice here, it's referring to, and this primarily in terms of gender roles plays out in marriage, you know, where the husband's given the leadership authority role in the family. But again, you mentioned this, and oftentimes what happens, well, that's inequality. Well, that's oppression. Well, notice here, it talks about God the Father being the head of Christ. Is Christ a second-class citizen in the God family? Does he have an insignificant, oppressed role at all? He's creator of all. He's King of kings, Lord of lords, and savior of mankind. That's pretty significant. You know, he has a very meaningful, very significant role. By virtue of the fact that the Father is head and has authority over him, doesn't marginalize his role. And there's also another role, and there's a lesson for this in husbands as well. How does God the Father treat Christ? You know, does he treat him as someone who just needs to shut up and stay in the kitchen and not have a role? No, not at all. You know, they have a very collaborative relationship. You know, he very much honors Christ's role and values that and is treated with great respect, you know, in terms of how they interact with each other. But again, there is this issue of the Father being head. You know, and you see a number of times where Christ is said he's submitting to, you know, to the Father when the Father has made the final call on things. But again, that doesn't make Christ insignificant. But it's important to realize with this whole issue of being head, again, there's two sides to this story. Because oftentimes looked at, well, he gets the say, he gets the primary role. There's also another side that comes with that. Let's not cherry pick. Let's turn over to Genesis chapter 3. Genesis chapter 3. We're going to pick up in verse 8, but let me just summarize what's led up to this point so you kind of understand what's happening here. I'm sure we're probably all familiar with the story of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. Because as you know, ultimately, they both wind up sinning. They take of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and they wind up basically, as that symbolized, you know, embracing Satan as the source to follow rather than God, you know, which is symbolized by the tree of life. Now, if you're familiar with the details of the story, you know the order of what happened. You know, so Satan basically approaches Eve first. She's the first person who sins, you know, and who takes of it, and she's instrumental in then going to Adam and talking him into doing it. Now they both mess up. They both sin and are responsible for this. But again, technically speaking, who's the first person who did it? That was Eve. And not only is she the first person who did it, she's instrumental in getting Adam to do it. Who is the first individual called on the carpet for it? Who gets the primary responsibility? Look here in verse 8. Genesis 3, verse 8. And they heard the sound of the Lord of God walking in the garden in the cool of the day. And Adam and his wife hid themselves from among the presence of the Lord among the trees of the garden. And the Lord God called to Adam and said to him, "Where are you?" And he said, "I heard your voice in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked, and I hid myself." And then he said, "Who told you that you were naked? Have you eaten of the tree which I commanded you that you should not eat?" And then the man said, "The woman whom you gave me to be with me, she gave me the tree, and I ate." And the Lord said to the woman, "What is it you have done?" And the woman said, "The serpent deceived me, and I ate." I notice, but both of them are running for cover. Everybody's looking for, you know, it's not my fault, it's somebody else's fault. You know, no one's wanting to take responsibility for their actions here. But notice the order that God has gone in. He went straight to Adam and said, "What have you done, Adam? You messed up." Adam wasn't the first guy that did it, was he? We know the order of the story. But notice what he's doing. He's going to the head, the guy who was placed in charge, and he's the one being held first responsible. Because if you notice in the New Testament, when we talk about sin entering the physical creation in mankind, who takes the primary blame? Who's exclusively mentioned as the person responsible? That's going to be Adam. Turn over to Romans chapter 5. Romans chapter 5 and verse 12. Therefore, just as through one man sin entered the world, and death through sin, and that thus death spread to all men because all sin. For until the law was in the world, but sin is not imputed when there is no law. Nevertheless, death reigned from Adam to Moses, even over those who had not sinned according to the likeness of the transgression of Adam, who is the type of him who was to come. But the free gift is not like the offense. For if by the one man's offense many died, much more the grace of God, and in the gift but by the grace of the one man, Jesus Christ, abounded to many. And the gift is not like that which came from the one who sinned, for the judgment which came from one offense resulted in condemnation, but the free gift which came from many offenses resulted in justification. For if by one man's offense death reigned through the one, much more also those who receive abundance of grace, all the gift of righteousness, will reign in life through the one Jesus Christ. Therefore, as through one man's offense judgment came to all men, resulting in the condemnation, even so through one man's righteousness the free gift came to all men, resulting in justification of life. For as by one man's disobedience many were made sinners, so also one man's righteousness many will be made righteous. Notice here it's talking about, well, you know, sin entered the physical creation through one man, and who's mentioned? Adam. Who technically was the first human who sinned? Eve. But you notice her name's not mentioned. She's not being held up for this. Because, well, think about it. Who is the head of the team? Think about it in terms of, if you're on a work team, you know, and you're given a particular responsibility, and that team doesn't deliver, or something goes wrong, and they mess up their responsibility, who's the person who tends to get blamed the most for it? It's the manager or the team leader, isn't it? It's the person who's made as the head. Or if a company has gone really off course and they're not doing well, and the board wants to say, well, we got to change this, we got to turn the direction of this company, who tends to get fired? That's the president or the CEO, isn't it? It's the person who's placed in charge. They go, he's accountable, even though there's lots of other folks under him that messed up as well. We're going to remove the head and fire him and then put somebody else in. That's kind of what's happening here. See, it wasn't just the issue of Adam. He gets to be the head. He gets to call the shots. He gets the accountability when it all goes wrong, too. You know, and so he gets by. It comes with, you know, to whom much is given, much is required. So I want you to look at this and see, you know, again, our human nature perspective of things is oftentimes we cherry pick. Because oftentimes in our culture today, people will look at the subject of the Bible, specifically as it deals with gender roles. And again, they're coming from this whole perspective of equality. And then they look at, you know, the Bible is this outdated, ancient, you know, sexist, anti-women book. And what they're going to do is a very cherry-picked view. They're going to typically look through the Bible and find anything that is, you might say, a perk or a right or an upside, you might say, that men receive that maybe women don't. Or they're going to take anything that is kind of, you might say, a kind of a downside that women received that men didn't, and say, see, inequality, you know, it's oppression. But oftentimes it's a cherry-picked view, and they're not looking at both sides of the picture. Because just to cover one other concept here, turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 20. Because see, oftentimes, particularly in looking at the Old Testament, what will happen is people will go through and again, kind of cherry-pick all the views of any particular rights or privileges that men had that women didn't, and say, see, this is oppression and inequality. Oftentimes, one of the things that you don't hear, you know, is one of the issues that is, one of the downsides that women didn't have to deal with, and that's the issue of military service and war. To turn over to Deuteronomy 20, verse 1, what we're going to read here is the biblical rules of war. So when you go out to battle against the enemies and see horses and chariots and people more numerous than you, do not be afraid of them, for the Lord your God is with you, who brought you up in the land of Egypt. So it shall be when you are on the verge of battle that the priest shall approach and speak to the people. And he shall say to them, hear, O Israel, today you are on the verge of battle with your enemies. Do not let your heart be faint, and do not be afraid. Do not tremble or be terrified because of them. For the Lord your God is he who goes with you to fight for you against the enemies to save you. And the officers shall speak to the people, saying, what man is there who has built a house and who has not dedicated it? Let him go and return to his house, lest he die in the battle and another man dedicate it. And what man is there who has planted a vineyard, who has not eaten it? Let him also go and return to his house, and lest he die in the battle, and another man eat of it. At what man is there who has betrothed to a woman, and who has not married him? Let him go and return to his house, unless he die in battle, and another man marry her. And the officer shall speak further to the people, and say, what man is there fearful and faint-hearted? Let him go and return to his house, and let his heart, the heart of his brethren, faint like his heart. Now notice here, it never says any rules for the women in regards to going to battle. They weren't required to do that. War is an ugly thing. You know, having to go fight in battle where you could get killed or severely wounded and disabled for the rest of your life as a result of your injuries, or again, just the horror of the things that you deal with in dealing with battle and war, is a pretty ugly thing. But notice the women didn't have to do that. This was something that they were spared from. So again, my whole point is here is just look at both sides of the picture. Because what tends to happen with human nature is like this. Well, I'm okay with missing out on the war part. They can take the battle and the risk in their lives and they getting killed. That's okay. Just give me the rights and the perks that they've got. That's my view of equality. You know, I don't want both sides. You know, but we have to realize life doesn't work that way. When roles are assigned, there's an upside and there's a downside, and they both come together as a package. Because as human beings, again, in our equality, it's just like the socialism view. Oftentimes, you know, my fair share, my equality, that's my portion of the profits. You know, that's not my fair share of the work and the sacrifice and the risk and all the negative parts that come with that. That's just my fair share of all the profits and the money. You know, well, it doesn't work that way. You know, that doesn't even meet their definition of equality. But what I want you to see in all of this is, again, the idea of equality, as is put across in our culture, is a very, very flawed idea. And again, if you look at Winston Churchill, how he described the concept of socialism, he called it the gospel of envy, you know, because that's oftentimes what it is. It's a very human nature, you know, perspective of wanting to cherry pick, you know. And I just thought it was important for us to establish this as a foundation as we go forward in looking at this and realizing that the cultural indoctrination that we've received on this subject has very much skewed our perspectives and our views on the subject. And I think that's important to look at. And again, I've established a lot of the foundation of establishing this sermon series, looking at, again, the primary cultural indoctrination that has infested our culture over the last several decades. And as we go forward looking at this subject, we're going to look first at the role of men and then at the role of women, and we'll certainly cover other angles and other ditches that we can be in. But we're about out of time today. So again, next time we'll pick up in part 3, looking specifically at the role of men. So I'll just close today by saying tune in next time for Biblical Gender Roles Part 3.